So guys, like, what is this exactly? What are we doing here?
We're drinking beer, which is good. We are drinking beer because it's the night before KiwiCon, and we have 70-odd hackers in here drinking beers, having a good time, and tomorrow we're going to go out, and there's going to be 300 dudes. And yeah, we're going to drink a beer, we're having a good time, and then tomorrow morning we're going to get up, and we're going to hack some stuff, and it'll be fun.
Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Sponsored by Verizon Business Security Solutions, powered by CyberTrust.
Hi, and welcome back to Risky Business. I took my first week ever off the show last week because I'd flown over to the KiwiCon Security Conference in New Zealand. I paid my own way over there because I'd seen the lineup of talks and it looked pretty damn groovy indeed. That audio from our introduction was recorded at the pre-party, and yes, that was in fact Adam Wallow, one of the conference organisers. And I can just tell you right now, as you can probably tell from that audio, it was a lot of fun. It was a big weekend. I came back with a pretty sore liver. And yes, I've come back with about 12 hours of raw recorded audio and a bunch of hot news stories. I was going to prepare a KiwiCon special for this week's podcast, but alas, I had to delay it. A couple of the presentations at the conference deserve to have some time dedicated to them on their own, so the special will have to wait a couple of weeks. Next week's show will be particularly interesting. We'll be unveiling details of a vulnerability affecting Microsoft's Windows, and yes, it makes Vista users ownable too. An old, old, hairy, scary bug in Windows is back, and it's putting millions of systems at risk. After speaking with Microsoft, I agreed to hold off on publishing details of the flaw until Tuesday, December 4. So don't forget to come back next week to hear all about it. We'll also be publishing some snort signatures you can use to see if this problem affects you. They will be offered with no warranty whatsoever. Just a warning there. In this week's show, we'll be looking at crypto. We'll be playing excerpts from a KiwiCon presentation by Nick Breeze, a security consultant from Wellington in New Zealand. He works for securityassessment.com. He's a young guy and a bit of a gamer, and you'll hear how he's used a PlayStation 3 to crack passwords at insane speeds. Here's a teaser from that presentation.
Prior to people coming to this presentation, people knew that an Intel Core 2 could do about 10 million calculations a second. Suddenly that number's jumped up to 1.4 billion. That's quite devastating in regards to basically thinking about your number of years to crack things.
James McMahon from Verizon Business Security Solutions will join us for this week's sponsor interview. James will tell us why he thinks events like KiwiCon, which can sometimes be portrayed in sections of the media as a big scary event for criminals, are actually valuable to everyone. But first, it's time for a check of some of the big stories that hit the security community over the last couple of weeks with ZDNet Australia's editor, Munir Kataria. And Munir, the tax commissioner in the UK, has lost his job because he was a bit silly with some backed up data.
And it's so funny. It seems like everybody who was getting a child support or is on that register, 25 million of them in the UK, suddenly all their details are lost somewhere in a TNT envelope.
Yeah, now can you just recap the story there for our listeners, Munir?
Okay, basically what happened was that there were two discs that were sent to the National Audit Office from the HMRC, that's Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, and apparently the discs were lost and nobody realised they hadn't arrived until about, was it a week or two later, something like that, and these discs contained 25 million records and they were just protected with a password.
Yeah,
and I assume this was probably some Excel document or something like that, which is password protected, and we know how difficult that is to get by.
These guys who were victims of this, they weren't customers of some commercial organisation that was sloppy with their data. I mean, this is the government we're talking about. This is government information. It's the equivalent of the Australian Tax Office losing the financial details, including bank account information, of, you know, 10 million taxpayers. And I suppose it's reassuring, I guess, in this instance, to see the the tax commissioner in the UK actually accepting responsibility for sending unencrypted information through intergovernment mail, through internal government mail, it's good to see him actually fall on his sword, accept responsibility and resign.
Yeah, I know, but still, I mean, that's not going to help the 25 million people whose details are now, you know, at risk.
Well, I don't think they're just at risk. I mean, you know, they're out there. I just wonder, though, whether or not this envelope wound up, you know, it's probably wedged under the seat of some truck driver. You know, it's probably not actually being used by Russian hackers, but the fact that you don't know, that's not real good.
No, it doesn't help at all. This is the kind of time where you think, you know, you get these self-destructing discs. I think this is the kind of thing that they ought to be using for transporting this kind of stuff. You know, if it's like not found or it's disappeared within a certain period of time, you should be able to press that something and all the data evaporates.
That would be cool. That's very Mission Impossible, isn't it?
God, it's got to happen. I mean, come on, that would be one great way of sitting reassured here. It's like, okay, fair enough, we can't find it. Hit self-destruct.
Well, you could just encrypt it. I mean,
yeah, that would be the other way of doing it, really. But that's been around for a very, very long time, and nobody seems to be using it.
But I mean, if they don't encrypt it right, do you reckon they're going to use the special self-destruct magic Mission Impossible discs?
Oh dear.
You know, I mean, I'm somewhat skeptical about that, Mania.
I know what you're saying. It's true. It's out there now. But I mean, I really love this. It's like, so far the data has not been found, said Alistair Darling, I think. And he goes, the police told me there is no reason to believe that this has fallen into the wrong hands or been used for fraudulent purposes.
Mm.
That's reassuring.
Yes, very reassuring. We don't know where it is, but we're pretty sure it's not being used by criminals.
Yes.
We don't have any information to support that, but that's what we're going to say. Some guys have done some nasty things to the iPhone, which have turned it into a bit of a snooping tool.
Now, we've been talking about this for a little while, actually, and it just seems that somebody's finally gone and done it. They're using that same, the jailbreak hacking system before, and now it seems that, you know, you get just taken to the wrong web address and suddenly your system's all loaded up with proper spyware, which can use your microphone or your camera and look at all your stuff, really.
That's it. I mean, evil hacksaws can be watching you while you use your iPhone.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a surprise. We knew it was going to happen. It's just finally happened.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit creepy, isn't it, when we've got microphones and cameras in all of these devices that, yeah, I mean, it's one thing having a camera on your, you know, your iMac or, you know, whatever, your Vio or whatever it is that you use while you work. It's another thing entirely having a microphone and a camera that can be owned wandering around everywhere you go. You can't think of a much better spying device than a mobile phone, can you?
No, I mean, there's been all this talk, I mean, you know, for the past couple of years or so about the US government and their secret service having a way of switching on your microphone on your mobile phone without you knowing. But, I mean, this one now is with the criminals.
Yeah, anyone can do it. The democratization of snooping. I think that's how the criminals would like to portray it, you know? It's just, it's now what they call a level playing field.
Yeah. Apparently, the issue here has been patched, so if you've updated everything, then it's fine, you're not vulnerable to it. But, I mean, there's going to be so many more in there, aren't there, really? I'm sure these jailbreaking guys are fighting with Apple, as soon as one manages to break through, then Apple patches it, and so there's bound to be another one out there, which I'm sure we'll hear about any time.
Yep. Now, I guess another thing that's worth mentioning is that the election result in Australia over the weekend, in which the Liberal Party, which is actually Australia's Conservative Party, which confuses the crap out of everyone who lives outside of this country, they got absolutely trounced in the election. They are gone, daddy gone. J-Ho is out of the his house, and that means that the proposed ID card is looking a little bit shaky.
Now all those promises they made before, they're going to actually have to, well, work their way around.
Unless they are in the words of our former Prime Minister, non-core promises.
Hey, does that mean that we can call it the ID card again?
I think we can.
Yes.
Instead of calling it the Government Services Access Card or whatever it was that they insisted we call it. Okay, well, I think that's actually, we're going to have to keep it quick today because we've got quite a lot to get through on the program. But Mania, thank you very much for joining us again. Welcome back. Good to have you back in the country.
It's good to be back, mate. I'll catch you soon.
That was ZDNet Australia's editor, Mania Katadia, there, with some of the news items that have affected the IT security world over the last fortnight. It's time now to turn our attention to all things crypto. We know by now that brute forcing crypto schemes like 128-bit SSL is simply unfeasible. But the competition to be the fastest in cracking smaller keys and insecure passwords, as used in Microsoft products, for example, is a heated contest indeed. Several weeks ago, Russian-based company Elcomsoft announced it had used the processors on graphics cards to achieve a 25-fold increase in password cracking speeds. And they got the headlines they were after. Not to be outdone, our Kiwi mate Nick Breeze, a presenter at the KiwiCon conference in Wellington and a securityassessment.com staffer, has shown us how to speed up the process by a factor of 100 by using the powerful vector-based processors found in the PlayStation 3 gaming console. Unlike a scalar processor like Intel's Core 2 Duo, the PS3's so-called synergistic processing units, or SPUs, are very good at crunching vector-based calculations. These revolve around things like working with matrices in mathematics to model 3D environments, very handy in gaming. Well, it turns out the same CPU instructions are ideal for cracking passwords. Nick found that he could run 1.9 billion MD5 hashes per second on the PS3 versus around 18 million on the Core 2 Duo. We'll pick up towards the end of Nick's presentation now, where he talks about what his research actually means, the impact it'll have. It's pretty techie, but stick with it. This is interesting stuff. Cracking hashes, as it turns out, can be used to do all sorts of stuff, like mess with BitTorrent downloads on a massive scale.
I've been developing this tech. I've got a benchmark up. It's not in, well, what I would call a crackable sort of state or anything like that. The code runs. I've got some benchmarks. So I'm happy. However, what about some actual consequences? You've got to bear in mind, again, that when suddenly, you know, we're talking about cryptography algorithms and security, we're talking about how long it would take to crack these things. Prior to people coming to this presentation, people knew that, an Intel Core 2 could do about 10 million calculations a second. Suddenly that number's jumped up to 1.4 billion. That's quite devastating in regards to basically thinking about your number of years to crack things. Suddenly, BitTorrent. BitTorrent relies on SHA-1 for all of its blocks. You've got to think about how you do collisions. So, just explaining how BitTorrent works. BitTorrent, of course, is put up into little chunks, and you've got a hash for each chunk. I'm oversimplifying it here, but just bear with me. If we were to take this chunk and replace an executable which is residing in it with our own malicious one, and we were then able to pad out this little block with data to get a collision of that hash, suddenly I can be there as a peer talking to a tracker and uploading my poison block to everybody else downloading this. And that's incredibly lethal when you're talking about ISOs being downloaded or pirates going and downloading games and so forth. Suddenly you've got everybody there at your fingertips and you can throw your poison blocks to everybody as quickly as you can. Sort of password cracking. So passwords usually are stored in an unsalted, just a simple MD5 hash within web applications and things like that. The good people add salt onto it, and that's to avoid rainbow table attacks. Quick refresh for rainbow tables. We've got a column of plaintext values and a column of pre-computed values of the MD5 hash equivalent. And if we were to get an MD5 hash, we just look up on our table, find out what this MD5 hash correlates to this plaintext information. It's just a lookup. The way you evade that is by adding salt, adding something into the mix so that somebody can't pre-compute your values. But the trouble with this technology, of course, is that salt doesn't matter. We know the salt, so therefore we can just add it into our mix, and we're still just doing cracks. Oh, one important, pertinent sort of thing is NSA at home. Has anybody heard of it? Just nobody? NSA at home was a really, really sweet MD5 cracking implementation using FPGA boards. So this is as close as you can get to hardware sort of level of MD5 calculations. They managed to do the 72-character key set of eight-character passwords in 2 days. So if you had your MD5 hash there, it would be able to break it, no matter what character you used, within reason, within 2 days, which is quite frightening. This works about half the speed. So now when I'm sort of mumbling to people about this sort of technology, you get a couple of questions sort of popping up. Like, what about my Linux? Linux, of course, everybody sort of thinks, oh, okay, it's an MD5-based implementation for storing passwords. So that's vulnerable, right? The biggest defense is the fact that Linux is, basically it's a crypt routine based off MD5. It uses MD5, but it does other things. So it cycles through MD5 1,000 times. So password A gets hashed into this hash, and this hash is then hashed to this hash. And I've got no way to break it. I can't interrupt that cycle, get in the middle. I would have to go through and do each step. Now, somebody will think, oh, okay, well, that's cool, it beats PlayStation 3, but now suddenly, okay, I just need 1,000 PlayStation 3s. The gap's closing. This is what I want to point out, is the fact that suddenly we've got this mechanism for storing, for hashes, which was touted as having this sort of life sign, and this is how long it's going to take until people can crack this within this certain time. Because we've got the sudden leap, people need to sort of act a hell of a lot more quickly. Basically, a new hash is needed for your Linux systems and to possibly do more than 1,000 iterations. I hear that there's currently the equivalent of the AES hash, cipher. There is a new hash standard that's currently in the making, and you've got all these people coming up with their proposed hash implementations, which is going to be the equivalent of AES today, the Advanced Encryption Standard. You're going to have basically the Advanced Hash Standard or whatever it's going to be. So we need that, and we probably need that about now. We've got some good alternatives, but yeah. Throw the count up to, instead of doing 1,000 iterations, why not 10,000? Windows, oh look, you're pretty screwed. I mean, people who come up to me and go, oh, so you can crack my Windows password faster. Unfortunately, this is a little bit beyond that. Windows password hashing is not that good. If you've got an XP box, you've actually got two hashes being stored on your box. You've got LM hashes and NTLM hashes. LM hashes are the very, very weak DES-based implementation. Very easy to crack. It also splits up values. You can use rainbow tables, and if you've got someone's SAM file, you can crack something in there. Now, I don't have Vista installed anywhere and really don't intend to, but apparently, right, NTLM hashes appear to be MD4-based, and what they do is, so instead of, you know, your 7-bit ASCII and so forth, they'd use UTF-16 character encoding and apply an MD4 hash to it, and that's an NTLM password. I agree it's stronger, but that's still pretty bloody weak. There's no 1,000 iterations or anything like that, and I believe that's still the Vista standard. It's got rid of the LM hashes, but it still uses that. You think about the problems that you have with this sort of discovery and how you mitigate it. What about defense? Why can't we just hook up a PlayStation 3 and do, say, 1,000,000, 10,000,000 iterations of MD5 in order to come to our password hash that we're going to store? Well, that's impractical, and I don't know if you're a large ISP or something like that. Good luck trying to convince your bosses to go buy you 1,000 PlayStation 3 for your servers to tack on. Why not have a PCI-based card with the cell processor on it? You're basically doing offload in terms of send and forget and just retrieve the value. So why doesn't IBM come out with something like that? If you had something like that, then suddenly we could basically be doing all of our cryptography level stuff at this high standard, opposed to down here, which we're currently at. So you've got issues in regards to, say, you know, marketing and stuff like that. Currently this cool sale thing is in this thing called the PlayStation 3 and everybody's happy playing games. But at the same time, we've got problems like this, and if you want to go buy a cell-based processor in the commercial world, you've got to go buy IBM Blade servers and stuff, which cost a fair amount of cash.
You're listening to Nick Breeze's presentation on using a PS3 to crack passwords, recorded at the KiwiCon Hacker Conference on the weekend before last. As we mentioned, Russian-based company Elcomsoft claimed to have accelerated password cracking by a factor of 25 a few weeks ago. Here's what Nick had to say about that.
Elcomsoft announced that they were going to patent cryptography on GPUs. So Alcomsoft are involved in basically password retrieval, which is such a nice name for password cracking. Suddenly they've come out with the announcement that they've filed a patent application for cracking things on a GPU. GPU, again, is a vector-based processor. It is. And, hell, why not? Why not leverage on this? You've got this processor which is on your PC. Why not use it? It's not very fast compared to that. So they said that they were running cracks at 25 times of the performance. So if you were to use, say, the 10 million calculations a second as a benchmark, and they were getting 25 times the amount, so that's, 250 million? That's still short of 1.4 billion. It's also worth pointing out the fact that I've got the code running up to 1.92 billion calculations a second. It's just that I thought I'd use the lower number for while I'm screwing around with this. Cool. Thank you very much.
That was Nick Breeze presenting at the KiwiCon Hacker Conference in Wellington, New Zealand. And we'll be bringing you a great deal more from KiwiCon over coming weeks. In fact, I'm planning a series of summer listening podcasts to run over January featuring talks and interviews from KiwiCon. It's time for this week's sponsor interview now. Verizon Business Security Solutions has supported this podcast since it started back in February. So each week we let one of their boffins come onto the show to demonstrate precisely how clever they are. And this week we're talking to James McMahon, who works as a professional services manager with Verizon Business Security Solutions in Canberra, and we're talking to him about hackers. James works for a big square telco, so I wanted to know if he thinks hacker conferences like KiwiCon are actually useful and important to guys like him. You know, the guys who work in the part of the security world where everyone wears a tie. Here's what he had to say.
I actually think it's very important. There's a lot of stuff that these guys are going to find, and if they're actually doing things in the right way and sharing that knowledge in a way that helps people defend, then that's one of the prime ways that we find out about how people are breaking into systems.
It's interesting though, isn't it? Because often there's reactions when people hear, oh, there's a hacker conference going on in Wellington or going on in Sydney or wherever it is. You know, people get all emotional, don't they, about that stuff and quite suspicious of the motives of the people who deliver the talks at those cons.
But that's to do with the change in definition in society of the word hacker. Over the last few years, and many years now, hacker has changed from being someone who is technically capable and someone who knows about their systems to being this bad black hat character who's out there to destroy the world.
Do you think the attitude within the security community, and by that I mean the Square security community with companies like Verizon Business Security Solutions, ISS and, you know, VeriSign and all that, do you think those sort of companies have softened their attitudes towards these sort of conferences?
I think so. And I think you'll find that a lot of people are actually having representatives there to see what's going on. I definitely had staff members who were interested in going to KiwiCon, but unfortunately, due to budgets and other things, we didn't have the opportunity to have them there. The information that's coming out of these places, people are actually understanding, and people are seeing that in having this in the public domain, we get a better opportunity to defend against and to see how people are operating in the real covert world.
So I guess, I mean, these guys are a little bit closer to what's going on in the evil sphere than people in the commercial world, but I guess that's really because there's a bit of overlap in the research between the good guys and the bad guys, so they're going to sort of bump into each other every now and then, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, the one thing we can absolutely be certain of is that the bad guys out there who want to break into a system, who want to steal your credit card numbers, your passwords, all of that sort of activity, are doing this research. That's how they're going to make their money. So if we're not doing that, if the only way we find out about how they're breaking into a system is by auditing something afterwards, if they're good enough, they've covered their tracks and you don't find much anyway. If we're not doing some of this research, then how are we actually going to fix these systems and make sure that it's harder for the bad guys out there to steal our money?
Would you agree with the proposition that the most interesting research really does come from those white hat hackers who are more driven by their curiosity than a paycheck?
Yes. Yes, I would. Anyone who's doing something purely for the paycheck at the end of the week, that's all they're doing.
Mm.
They're going to do their job, no problems. There's plenty of people out there who are, I've got my paycheck at the end of the week, that's what I come to work for. But the people who are passionate about something are the people who go home and play and who take that Cisco router that's sitting on the shelf and put whatever on it and see what vulnerabilities I can find, see what I can get out of this thing and do that for fun.
Mm.
They're the people who are really going to know what's going on in these systems.
So you really are a believer in the role that these guys play in securing, you know, the Square enterprise.
Yes. There's a lot that can go wrong with it. I think this comes down to the disclosure debate. To disclose or not disclose when you find a vulnerability, what are you trying to do there? So if a bug is there, then doing the right thing about it and saying, right, I found something wrong with your product. Here it is. Here's how you do it. Are you going to do something about fixing it? And giving the people that chance is doing the right thing. If you just put it out there and say, guess what, everyone? Microsoft or Cisco or whatever product it is that you care to name has this security vulnerability. And if you do exactly this, you can get password files, you can get credit card files, you can deface a website, whatever mischief it is that you want to do, then all of a sudden you've thrown that information out to the black hat community who want to do that.
Mm.
Because they're the people who have the interest and the motivation to actually be monitoring all of these lists and things where such vulnerabilities get published.
Mm.
You have also probably, you've put some pressure on the company that owns the product because they should be watching what's happening to their product and hence then get a chance to fix it. But the very few people who are using that product, I'd say it's a very low percentage of people who are using this product who would actually be watching those lists and hence then become aware of that vulnerability. Time they start becoming aware of is
when the vendor puts out, a patch. So at the end of the day, it really does come down to that full disclosure debate. And I guess what you're saying there is if people act within ethical boundaries, then it's not so much a problem.
Yes.
Okay. I guess the other question as well, around this same sort of thing is one of the criticisms leveled towards these types of conferences is the idea that anyone can turn up and, you know, network and gather a lot of information on these sorts of vulnerabilities and attack methods. Do you think that people should be concerned over that sort of information sharing, or do you think it's important that these guys all get together and do bone up on their skills? You know, I mean, do you worry that there's a lot of black hats turning up to these things and learning stuff?
I'm sure that some of the people who turn up there are black hats. I mean, you look at some of the other conferences, the black hat conferences and things in the States, and I'm sure that there's a reasonable amount of proportion who are learning these things.
Mm.
But I think there's probably no greater risk of that collaboration than there is of the collaboration that goes on every day on IRC chats and things amongst the covert hacker groups.
So you think it's better to really pull this stuff out into the open and have it discussed, you know, in a conference where, I suppose, media can turn up, anyone can really turn up?
I think so.
Okay, well, James McMahon, thank you very much for taking some time out to speak to Risky Business this week.
Pleasure.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of A Risky Business. Okay, well, we hope you'll tune in again next week for more news and analysis from the spooky, shady, shadowy world of information security. Until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
I went to KiwiCon. It was choice, eh, bro? It was sweet, eh? I think Aussies have funny accents, eh, bro? You sound better than me. Yeah, man, it was pretty cool. They told us everything about computers and computer security and stuff on the internet. Yeah, my uncle showed me when I was a kid how to hack a sheep, bro.